This is episode 36 of the Home and Family Culture Podcast. I'm Jody Chafee. In this episode, I interviewed Carol Danaher, MPH RDN President and Faculty at Ellen Satter Institute. Welcome to the Home and Family Culture Podcast, where I discuss how families can discover and design their collective vision, values, beliefs, and traditions that influence their family culture. In this podcast, I interview experts who offer tips and tools to inspire families in this process of developing their family culture, and also successful individuals whose success was influenced by their family culture growing up. Be sure to check out the show notes for this and every episode at homeandfamilyculture.com, where you can subscribe for my weekly newsletter filled with updates on the podcast and blog, as well as other tidbits of information I like to add. You can listen to this podcast on iTunes, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, Stitcher, or YouTube. Please subscribe to your favorite medium. You can also find me on social media at Family Culture Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and Pinterest, and at _FamilyCulture on Twitter. Be sure to comment, follow, like, rate, and share. But enough about all of that. Let's get to the episode. Thank you for listening. Carol Danaher is board president and faculty at the Ellen Satter Institute. She is a registered dietitian nutritionist with a Master of Public Health from Johns Hopkins. She co-founded the Childhood Feeding Collaborative of Santa Clara County, California, creating partnerships and training in feeding dynamics for pediatric service providers of all kinds. Carol worked at the national level at the United States Department of Agriculture evaluating child nutrition programs. She consults with child care programs, helping them design and establish positive feeding policies and environments. She is an experienced educator. Volunteer work in the 1970s at Jakarta, Indonesia, led to her interest in public health. Carol was a Girl Scout leader for 12 years. Carol has two married children and a toddler-aged granddaughter. Welcome, Carol.
Oh, thank you very much, Jody. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm so glad you could be here. That's awesome. I love that you studied public health. That was, I studied health promotion. And so I covered a little bit of public health in my studies also. And that's awesome.
Yeah, thank you. It's a powerful field to influence populations.
It's big and broad, and people don't even realize that it influences and impacts their daily life, really.
Yes, that's true.
It's true. So awesome. So tell us more about Ellen Satter Institute. What is the Ellen Satter Institute, and what is their mission?
Sure. In the most broad sense, the mission is to further and sustain the very pioneering work of Ellen Satter. And we do this in two ways. One, we train and empower professionals like dietitians and mental health professionals, pediatricians, in applying both Satter's division of responsibility and also her eating competence model. And then secondly, through teaching the division of responsibility to families, we really aim to help empower parents to feed their children, I'll just use the phrase, with love and good sense. And so feeding can be joyful, and it should be. You know, really, the work that we do, it transforms lives. It's really powerful.
Yes, totally. I mean, as a mom, I can see how the things that I've learned from Ellen Satter going on the website and her books is that, you know, it's a big responsibility to feed our kids and help them to enjoy eating, you know, instead of this constant struggle and this battle. So you mentioned about the division of responsibilities and competent eating. Can you describe what, in a nutshell, what the division of responsibilities is?
Sure. So the division of responsibility is defines the unique parent and child roles in the feeding relationship. And you know, anybody who's eaten with a child knows there's so much parenting that goes on.
Yeah.
There's the conversation, there's teaching through the conversation, there's role modeling. It just is nonstop parenting. And so the feeding relationship is acknowledges that this is a relationship-based activity. Mm-hmm. And so what Satter was able to do so brilliantly was to define what those unique roles are in the feeding relationship. And there are five different roles, 3 for parents, 2 for children. And parents are responsible for what food enters the house and is served to the family, where eating is allowed, and when eating is allowed.
Okay.
So in other words, all the structural basic decision makings about the meal time and food.
What, where, and when. Okay.
Yep.
Got it.
And then the child is responsible for, within that structured, within that context of parent responsibilities, for how much to eat from what the parent provides and whether or not to eat what the parent provides. And most people really agree with those 3 parent responsibilities, but they struggle so much with the child responsibilities.
Yes.
Because you have to trust the child with their eating to follow those. The vision of responsibility is sometimes called the trust model.
Yes, because it's so easy to, I prepared this food, you're going to eat it, or you have to eat so much of everything, or, you know, it's very easy to fall into that. I mean, we catch ourselves even doing that, like, we prepared this, please at least try. Yeah. So many bites.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is that parents, we really shouldn't even put pressure on them to even taste different foods?
Well, it's... The division of responsibility is very developmentally based.
Okay.
And so, you know, it changes as a child develops and becomes more competent.
Right.
So for something like not even suggesting. So if it's a, like with my 18-month-old granddaughter, I would never suggest, because she is so driven by her, you know, she's got these internal drives that tell her, today I'm only eating the meat, today I'm only eating this, or today I'm eating everything.
Right.
And cognitively, it would just mean, because she's in this, you know, emerging age of becoming independent, becoming a toddler, she would just say no, it would be a negative. But a 4-year-old, a 3-year-old, you could say, you know, because cognitively they can process information like this, you might like this, mm-hmm. go ahead and try it. You know, if you don't like it, you can spit it out politely. And here's what you do in your napkin, you model that behavior. And so, you know, there's rarely any yes or no straightforward questions with rearing children, right?
Right.
And so that question is really, it's a developmental stage-based question.
Right. So it depends on your child. You know who your child is, what they can handle, you know, the discussion that you can have together. So it's not like, with little children, you can't forcibly feed them, first of all, right?
Yeah.
And so, well, I think too that this division of responsibility really lifts a burden on the parents, because, you know, it's okay, if they don't eat it, then I'm not going to stress out of it, because today they might not want it, but then tomorrow they might. And as long as they, over a time, getting a balance, what's the big deal? Like, child, you're trusting the child to listen to their own bodies. Right? Is that?
Yep. That's right. That's right. Because every one of us is born with ability to regulate hunger and satiety. And this is just part of being able to survive in the world. No parent can understand or know exactly what a child needs to eat at any different time.
You don't know what's going on in their body.
No. I mean, if they're going to be sick in 2 days, their appetite's dropped. So, you know, you don't know that. If their growth is slowing or accelerating, that'll impact it. And there's just a lot.
That's so interesting. And also, you know, like when I studied the health promotion, I studied a lot of the psychology around food and things. And I think, I believe that I read this in either on one of your website or in one of the books, was that, you know, it's like, if you are forcing your child to eat more, then that causes stress and it's a power struggle. It just becomes a power struggle, right? If you're saying eat more or don't eat so much, you're getting fat. How much stress that creates on just the child, who then stops listening to their own body. And then their cues are turned to a social, you know, cues about eating and body image and how destructive that can be.
It's really destructive, and it's also counterproductive. Children who are told to eat more tend to eat less, and vice versa with the other. So pressure, I mean, we're talking about is pressure in different ways. And pressure is, any form of pressure is really the parent taking over the child's responsibilities. In fact, you know, with most feeding problems, if the division of responsibility if parents take over the child's responsibility or they give up, say, one of their responsibilities to the child, say the child begs for, they don't want like what's served at dinner. And so they beg for.
They have to have mac and cheese.
Yeah, mac and cheese. And if the parent capitulates to that,
right,
they have handed over their responsibility to the child.
Interesting.
And so whenever those responsibilities are handed to the child or vice taken over by the wrong party, then there's feeding issues. That's a way to think about what you're doing behaviorally as a parent.
Yeah. And I believe I read on your website too, that it was always provide something on the table at these times that you designate when to eat and where and what, something that's familiar to your child. So it's not always this struggle of constantly giving them new things, or, you know, the novelty of trying new things is kind of scary sometimes for kids. And so if you always allow something on the table that they recognize, then that will make it easier as well.
Yeah. And it's really just polite. You know, if you had a dinner party, you would not serve a meal that most of your guests hated. And so you have to realize that the child, even though they may only eat the bread you put on the table, and there's the eggplant parmesan, which they are not going to go near, they're going to observe you eating that. I love to cook, and I cook all different types of food. And when my kids were young, I would, I cook a lot of Indian food.
Mm-hmm.
And I had, this one, it was rice pulao. So it was just basically rice with saffron and peas and carrots and potatoes in it, a little cumin. And I loved it. It was great. And I'd serve it with other Indian foods. And my daughter would just did not like that. She refused it. I just continued serving it because the rest of us liked it.
Yeah.
And I think she was 10 years old. And I guess I hadn't cooked it for a while. And there it was. It appeared on the table. And she never had to eat it. But there it was. And she looked at that and she said, "Mom, why don't we ever have that? That's my favorite food." And I just started laughing. And she was old enough, and our relationship was such that I could remind her of what her history was. And so she started laughing too.
Oh, that's funny.
It may take 8 years or, but.
To see that you modeling the different, to eat different foods and see that that's part of your family culture, that you eat the food
right.
As a parent, then it's like, okay, eventually they'll see that and see you modeling that. That's awesome. Right.
And if you remind them to eat something they hate, or say, "I know you don't like it, so you can have this instead," you're just instilling in them this sense in themselves that they are someone who hates rice pulao, or
But so, then if you model for them and you show that trust in them, then eventually they come around and they feel like, "Oh, this was my idea." they kind of take ownership of that. Like,
exactly.
That's awesome.
And so you also asked about what's eating competence?
Yes.
And so, because they really go together. And eating competence in children means that they are able to go by their own internal feelings of hunger and fullness, that they feel good about eating, that they can learn to eat unfamiliar foods, and that they enjoy family mealtimes.
Mm.
And so, a lot of parents, if they think about their goals for their children, it might be that, I want my kid to eat vegetables and healthy food. And, in eating competence, there's no mention of food, right? Of healthy food.
Mm.
But those behaviors and attitudes are what's going to allow the child to learn to eat the family foods and to be, just this part of this family at the table. And so we really, with eating competence and division of responsibility, we're asking parents to go deeper into the foundations of how children learn and to take a really long-term view.
Yeah.
Because meal to meal, you'll just go crazy.
Yeah, right. So many awesome tips here. Okay. So let's talk more about this family mealtime and why is it so important to family culture?
Family meals are, I think anyone who has really pleasant family meals and that within their culture really understands that it's profoundly beneficial beyond just what food is served.
Yeah.
And what the research shows, which shouldn't surprise people who do enjoy family meals, is that having three or more family meals each week has profound benefits in terms of social health, mental health, behavioral health, and physical and nutritional health.
Yeah.
And so most of the research looks at having kids who have three or five family meals a week. And mm-hmm. what they find is that when in the presence of family meals, without ever asking parents what they're serving, children eat healthier, they eat fewer unhealthy foods, they have fewer disordered eating behaviors, mm-hmm. They have lower odds of obesity, of becoming obese.
Interesting.
And the benefits are greater the list goes on and on. But these are really different. This is a wide variety of benefits. And the benefits are greater if there are five or more. So there's a dose effect, right? More mm-hmm. family meals.
The consistency is really...
Yeah. And then what I find really interesting is Columbia University in New York has a center on alcohol and substance abuse. Mm-hmm. And every year they do a survey of teenagers, of adolescents on family meals. And here is, you know, this alcohol and substance abuse is what their deal is. And what they find is that teens with fewer than three family meals a week are more likely to use marijuana, alcohol, and cigarettes.
Wow.
And when they have these meals, three or more a week family meals, the adolescents report better relationships with their parents. They feel that their parents know more about what's going on in their lives, and they know more about what's going on in their parents' lives. I mean, it just doesn't get any bigger in terms of importance to family culture.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. It's really interesting.
That's awesome. Well, and I can think of so many reasons why, right? You get to sit down and have conversations, and food brings people together socially and things like that. And I'm sure that the number of reasons is you can't even describe. A lot of it is innumerable, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Why don't all families have mealtimes then, if this is so important, it's so crucial?
Yeah, good question. Well, there are perceived barriers. Families say that it just takes too much time to have a family meal, and it's a lot of work to prepare healthy foods. They say their kids don't behave, so mm-hmm. they want to eat separately. And, you know, maybe one or both parents come home too late at 7 or 7:30, so it's just not practical to have a family meal. And, you know, these are real concerns, but, yeah. you know, parents are also aware of how important family meals are to role modeling and instilling values in the kids. So there's this, yes, they're great, but yikes, I can't do it. And I think it helps, you know, parents have this feeling that family meal has to be homemade and healthy. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to give you the definition, Ellen Satter Institute's definition of a family meal.
Okay.
So listen carefully. So first, people sit down and face each other. The same food is offered to everyone. Third, the conversation is pleasant. And fourth, the television or media are off. So these are all relationship related, yeah. right? And so the family who is, you know, adds these burdens onto themselves, like it has to be homemade. It could be you stop at the takeout restaurant on the way home. You've got your bags of food. You go home, you put it on the table, you face each other, you have a great conversation, no screen time, and you're having a family meal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's, you know, the downside of everyone ordering a separate bag of food, right, from the takeout is that children aren't learning a broader variety of foods. But that doesn't mean you have to have a home-cooked, nutritious meal every day. It's far more important. Maybe you have that just on the weekends. Far more important to sit down together, whatever you're eating.
Yeah, because I was going to say that when you said that the study did not reflect what they were eating, as long as they're eating the same foods, like for these parents who get home late, like if they all gather at a restaurant or something, or, you know, or they like you said, bring home takeout, or, you know, that there's so many solutions that allow to resolve that, you know, so that you can find ways to manage
at least
three times a week, right?
Yeah, and sometimes maybe it's breakfast during, you know, some days, or maybe it's, you know, it's different on the weekends. You know, if I think if we value something, we find a way to make it happen.
Yeah.
Generally. Yeah. When my kids were young, when I had a, I think my son was probably two and my daughter was, no, my son was probably three and my daughter was just starting, was one. My husband is an attorney and attorneys can work 24/7 and never take a break. Right. But I was insistent that we have family meals. And so we did this, we had this negotiation. I said, you have to be home by 6:30. That's what'll work. And he said, I can't, I can't get home earlier than 7:30. And so it was just this back and forth. And we settled on 7:15. And it was 7:15. And what I did then was plan a later afternoon snack.
Mm.
And if that meant they didn't eat quite as much as at dinner time, that's fine. But we had our family meal.
You had to sit together.
That's awesome. but generally it didn't impact them in terms of what they ate. But you know, kids don't have to go to bed at 7 o'clock or 7:30. You know, when they're young, and that's they can hold out.
Yeah.
So, you know, with planning the snack time.
So when you're talking about these things and how to have meal times at specific, you know, you choose when and where and what as the parent. So sometimes what I struggle with is that I like my kids to be able to feel like they have freedom and that things are accessible to them. And my kids are still, they're 8 and younger, almost 9. Ooh. And for moms like me who struggle with my kids escaping into the pantry or the refrigerator and sneaking out food at pretty much any time of the day, like what would be your solution for that?
Yeah. So you know, your children are old enough that you can have a conversation with them.
Yeah.
And every parent should have a schedule for meals, a routine for meals,
mm-hmm.
and then a routine for snacks. And that varies. So always after school, I mean, kids are always hungry. So you have a scheduled routine and that's the time they can eat. And, you know, you just need to let them know what the rules are. Okay. And that the pantry is not available to you afterwards. You can have water, but this is why it's important for you to take time and sit and have a snack. And snacks are sit down. They're not walking around.
Or sitting in front of the TV, because that lends to emotional eating too.
right. And so, you know, you just have that dialogue, and whether it's 4 meals a day or whether it's 3 meals and 2 snacks, you know, it's...
Yeah.
Each family's a little different, but what's important is that it's predictable because their appetite and their hunger will begin to mesh with this schedule.
So that they come to expect it and then their bodies start to expect that.
Right. And it's also, there's good research on this as well. It's also better for adults if they eat according to schedule.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't matter what the schedule is so much, but that it's a routine rather than busy all day.
Yeah. So when I was telling some friends of mine about this, that, you know, to have these meals spaced out, they were like, oh, but they would get hungry. And don't they need to have something to keep them busy, like at church or at different things? And it was like, you know, I think more people can stand to feel hungry sometimes. You know, when you think about it as an adult, it's like, we feel like we have to constantly shove food in our faces at the like hint of feeling hunger or uncomfortable or anything like that. And it's like, wouldn't it be so much easier if we knew when to expect our meals and, you know, and not be constantly stuffing our faces, but, you know, drink some water, hydrate, or do something else that kind of curbs that hunger, to wait until a regularly scheduled meal time so that it's healthier and more balanced.
Yeah. And it is the parents, you know, you don't want children to get so hungry they fall apart because that's no good. So it's really up to the parent to say, oh, okay, they had this big soccer practice today.
Uh-huh.
You better have snack a little earlier and it better be a bigger snack. So the parent has to really tune in to the child and should never allow the child to get beyond that point of no return. But generally with those routines, yes, you can do that. And feeding a child in church rather than here's a snack, we're going to have a breakfast, you know, right before, or if your breakfast was hours before church, then you have a snack beforehand is, I think parents underestimate their children on what they can learn and behaviorally what's expected. And so, we sometimes use food to pacify a child or when really the child can learn to survive that moment without food.
I think one of my biggest challenges is in the grocery store.
Oh, and that's such a good challenge for learning.
So my kids really love sweets. And one of the things that you mentioned is that we don't say whether, like, we don't label foods as good or bad in the Ellen Satter model. Mm-hmm. And so how do you regulate if you feel like your kids love and they have sweet tooth and they love to eat treats, how do you help them regulate, you know, the amount of what we could say are less good food?
Yeah, well, you know, everybody, I love sweets. Who doesn't love sweets? We're biologically primed to.
Right.
So to neutralize sweets, and we may say that if you eat your vegetables or you eat whatever at dinner, then you can have dessert, or no dessert unless you
right. do this. So that labels it as a reward. Would you say that doesn't yeah. neutralize it anymore?
No, that's right. And that makes it like, whoa, dessert is awesome. Mm-hmm. And so it is one serving. We're children with a division of responsibility. Children eat as much or little that they want, so they could have 3 helpings of rice and no chicken.
Right.
But with dessert, it's only one serving because mm-hmm. it takes no learning to like dessert.
Right.
And having unlimited dessert then becomes an inhibitor to eating other foods.
Mm,
so
yeah.
that's the exception
okay.
with this model, and for a reason, an yeah. appropriate reason. And so it's important to have sweets occasionally, you know, yeah. not make them forbidden. Or if your family is really like, I'm just not going to buy sweets, allow your child to have them when they go to other places.
Okay.
And so if you're in the grocery store and they're begging for, you know, candy or whatever in the checkout line, you say, you know, our family just doesn't eat that.
Okay.
Mommy can't buy it. Mommy's not going to buy that. And that's all. You don't have to rationalize. It's just mommy's not going to buy it.
Right. That. You don't have to say, no, we don't bring that junk into our house or something. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, so I'll give you another story that I think illustrates it well. I had a friend of mine's child spent every couple weeks with us every summer. And we'd go up to a beautiful small lake in the Sierra Nevada mountains in California. And they had a little store that young children, I would allow my 6-year-old to walk to that store. We had an account there and they could buy, they just had to give their last name and they could buy whatever they wanted.
Wow.
And so I would send my children to get like snacks for a hike or something. So this child, all the way going to this location, he would talk about candy, the candy he was going to buy. And he was they had no sweets, no sugar. It was demonized. It was
right.
And then the first 3 days he was with us, that's all he could think about. He would go to the store and buy unbelievable quantities of candy. And I would just like calm myself and say, okay, he needs to do this. I'm just going to. And then by day 4 or 5, he forgot about it.
Hmm.
I mean, it was this, it didn't become an issue anymore.
Right.
Because he could have it. And so that, you don't want that. You don't want your child to be like that, right? You don't want them going yeah. to a birthday party and standing by the snacks, of the bowl of M&Ms, and shoving them in their mouth.
I'm just obsessed about them.
Right. And so allow them to have their Halloween candy. Allow them to gorge the first couple of days. Allow them to gorge on their Easter candy. You know, it's not going to hurt them. Don't allow it past a couple of days. That right. information on Halloween is on our website.
Okay.
But it's just neutralize it.
Yeah.
Healthy foods aren't any better. Don't talk about the virtues of vegetables. That's a disincentive for them to eat them. And don't, really neutral.
Interesting. So then my question would be, if you have treats in the house, then what you say is at mealtime, it's okay to have a treat out with the meal or after the meal so that yeah. it's something they can choose.
Yeah, you could serve it, you know, let's have it at snack, because you don't want them to have the treats and then have spoil their appetite.
Right.
And so you have it, let them have it after, you know, pick out what you want for dinner tonight, you know, with dinner tonight. Mm-hmm. And I'll let them pick it out. And then, you know, after 3 weeks or 2 weeks, whatever you decide, then it can disappear. I have a friend, he's a dietitian and has three young children, and he follows a division of responsibility. And the only way he can really be calm in doing that is during meal times, he only looks above their necks, you know, to their faces, so they, because they're having conversation, but he doesn't look down at their plate to see what they're eating or not. So, I mean, he's found that's what he had to do, but it, it made a difference for him.
Yeah. So, because, you know, something that's even starting younger and younger is kids who are dieting, kids who are starting to, stress about, you know, the social cues around food or, eating disorders and things like that. And people don't realize how sensitive our kids can be to those looks or those words that we say or things like that. And all of that is what comes into your family culture of what is it that you value? Is it really going to be that your child is eating exactly what you want them to eat? Or is that your child is healthy and has a healthy perception of themselves and that you love them regardless of you know, what they're filling their plate with. And so that's awesome. Great tips, great tools. What would you like to leave our parents with?
Well, I would like them to, if they could go on to the Ellen Satter Institute website.
Yeah.
And you had an, just because there's so much learning available there.
Yeah.
And look at some of the resources we have just posted online. Some of her books, Secrets of Feeding a Healthy Family, really good. My favorite baby gift is Child of Mine, because it goes into such detail on, it's a great resource. And then you had put a webinar on your Facebook, thank you, ABCs of Child Feeding. And that's offered four times a year.
Okay.
And you can see that on our website. And so I guess, you know, the take home message is to recognize that feeding a child is, it's a tough job, but it's worth every bit of effort you put into it to get it right. And getting it right is really recognized as following a division of responsibility. It's a parenting model that it's a parenting style that can be applied in other ways.
Yeah.
You know, it teaches you on how to be authoritative.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important. And you'll appreciate that throughout their lives and they will appreciate it.
Awesome. Awesome. So what's the URL for finding the Ellen Satter Institute?
Ellen Satter Institute, and Ellen is spelled E-L-L-Y-N.
Okay.
So Ellen Satter, S-A-T-T-E-R, institute.org. And have fun. It's an awesome website.
It's a great website.
Yeah, you can enjoy your mealtime.
Yeah. And then maybe that will lift some barriers in and of itself to have mealtime more often.
Because
it's not such a painful process.
There you go.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Carol. I really appreciate this information, and I will definitely put these links on my show notes.
Oh, thanks so much, Jody. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Awesome. Thank you all so much for listening. Please, please go check out EllenSatterInstitute.org. There's so many amazing resources there. And you can find my show notes at homeandfamilyculture.com and any books that I love to recommend at homeandfamilyculture.com/books. And that's my Amazon affiliate link that I would really appreciate you going on to support the Home and Family Culture podcast. And I love to recommend Audible as a great way to listen to all these books. That's how I get all my books in. I just love listening to books. So thank you so much for listening. Please like and rate and share and comment, and especially share on your social media and to your friends and family via email or otherwise. Thank you so much for your support, and thank you for listening. Have a great day.